In 1978, I first learned about Rocky Flats from a family friend who used to work there. One day, he drove me along the northeast boundary of this nuclear weapons facility. As we looked out over the 16 square miles of land where the plant resides, he explained what Rocky Flats made, a plutonium trigger, basically a Nagasaki-like atom bomb that ignites a much larger hydrogen bomb. Little did I realize at the time, but the Rocky Flats Truth Force was occupying the railroad tracks into the plant, drawing the nation's attention to this nuclear crossroads. 1978 became known as the Year of Disobedience.
Who's all the way out the gate?
As KGNU celebrates its 20th year on the air, we return to the nuclear crossroads. In this four-part series, we will look back at over two decades of protest and anti-nuclear activism centered on Rocky Flats. Today in part one, we'll hear the voices of the earliest activists as they began to learn about and to oppose Rocky Flats nuclear weapons production. I'm David Wilson, your host for Return to the Nuclear Crossroads. In 1973, the Vietnam War was winding down. Peace activists were emerging after years of anti-war work. A Catholic nun named Pam Solo was organizing for the American Friends Service Committee, a Quaker peace group. With the war ending, she began looking for a new focus. Pam Solo and a small group of AFSC members became some of the first Rocky Flats activists.
What we called back in those days the military-industrial complex was firmly, you know, established in our political and economic culture, and we needed to find a way to address those problems. And so Judy Danielson and I were trying to look at the ways in which Colorado was enmeshed in the systems of war making. Through that, we started learning more about Rocky Flats and doing some research and investigating it.
I think it was a time when citizens were beginning to pry open government secrecy.
In 1973, Paul Ware moved to Boulder to teach sociology at the University of Colorado. He joined up with Pam Solo, Judy Danielson, and several others to form the Rocky Flats Action Group.
It was about the time of the Nixon threatened impeachment and resignation. This plant that had been operating there rather secretively for 20, 25 years gradually became the center of attention for citizens who were, in a sense, just coming off the Vietnam War protest. Washington was unraveling. So I think there was a new hope on the part of peace-oriented activism that we could really start to open up the plant, essentially.
We didn't know a whole lot. We knew that it was there. We knew it had something to do with nuclear weapons. But it was a process of really uncovering the information. One of our strategies actually was to take seriously the fact that we didn't know very much. So we went to the governor's office, to the health departments, and started asking them, what goes on there? What do you know? Are you prepared if there's an accident? And in increments, started getting more and more information.
Some of the first people to show concern about Rocky Flats were local scientists. Nuclear chemist Ed Martell was one of them. At Boulder's National Center for Atmospheric Research, Martell focused his work on the biological effects of radiation. NCAR sits on the high mesa overlooking Rocky Flats to the southeast. In 1969, Martell watched from his office as a huge plume of smoke billowed out of Rocky Flats. It would prove to be the largest industrial fire in U.S. history up to that time. Dow Chemical was operating Rocky Flats for the Atomic Energy Commission when the fire happened.
My suggestion that the AEC or Dow make such measurements was they were not receptive to this suggestion. No, they took no initiatives to do it. And so we carried these first measurements out ourselves.
Martell found 400 times more plutonium than what he could account for from atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons before 1963. He blamed the fires at Rocky Flats. A local preventative medicine specialist followed up on Martell's work. Dr. Jock Cobb was an original member of the Rocky Flats Action Group. He voiced deep concern about plutonium contamination coming from the plant, especially when Dow Chemical admitted the plutonium Martell found was not from the 1969 fire, but rather thousands of barrels of oil that had leaked Rocky Flats plutonium into the environment during the 1960s.
Then they took up these drums and began pouring the oil from the leaking drums into new drums and getting rid of the old drums, and that stirred up quite a lot of more plutonium in the air. And the final thing they did was to cover it all over with gravel and asphalt to keep it from blowing. But they forgot that there was this part that had blown downwind a little way. They didn't cover that over with asphalt, and that continued to blow and still continues to blow because it's escaped now all the way down into Denver.
Cobb and Martell's work gave the public their first hint that Rocky Flats was producing the heart of each U.S. nuclear weapon, a 10-pound plutonium trigger. Rocky Flats could have just as easily been named Windy Flats. 100-mile-an-hour gusts would distribute plutonium from the plant across the Front Range and beyond. Rocky Flats Action Group members like Pam Solo and Paul Ware used this fact to dramatize the health threat the plant posed.
We're not sure what's going to happen this year. It looks like our balloons are ready over there.
We were trying to dramatize the problems of plutonium and airborne radioactive materials and what they could do. So we filled hundreds of balloons with helium and then tagged them with tags that said that the balloon had been released from Rocky Flats and what plutonium was, and gave the history of the fires and the release of radioactivity into the environment. If you find this tag, please return it.
We have received tags from these balloons. We've received tags mailed back from as far away as Indiana. So we know they go where the winds carry them. And as we release the balloons today, let's understand that there's a message that goes with those balloons. And it's the message that's plastered all over the Rocky Flats plant, signs all over the plant, and the signs say, ironically, "Life is fragile, handle with care." Here they go.
Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President.
The 1974 post-Watergate elections brought two new politicians onto the Colorado scene, Governor Dick Lamb and Congressman Tim Wirth. Pam Solo and other members of the Rocky Flats Action Group focused their efforts on getting these rookie politicians to take up the Rocky Flats cause.
Right after Wirth and Lamb were elected, we called for a citizens' committee to investigate Rocky Flats, and they appointed Rocky Flats Task Force. That investigation happened. That turned up a lot of information about Rocky Flats, and they made a report, and in that report recommended that the plant be closed and phased out over time, and that a permanent monitoring committee be put in place. I then was appointed as a member of the governor's monitoring committee. The goal of that, I thought, was to implement the recommendations of the task force, the key recommendation to close and convert the plant and phase out its operations in Colorado. It quickly became, I think, a target of the public relations machine to kind of diffuse public concern about the plant.
Pam Solo and other members of the monitoring committee often met at Rocky Flats and got the public's first view inside. She says the nuke speak she heard at the plant often left her with a profound sense of unease. The Rocky Flats Monitoring Committee, nonetheless, represented the first time an independent private citizens group was allowed access and information as to the internal workings of the U.S. nuclear weapons program.
We tried every avenue to push for public responsibility and for politicians to take action on behalf of their constituents to protect their health and safety. We knew at this point that in order to get real movement on Rocky Flats, we were going to have to make it a national issue. We had tried to make the structures of democracy work for us, and we were now escalating the campaign.
Stand up and tell them you're here. Shout it out loud for the whole world to hear. They're long overdue for a kick in the rear. Stand up and tell them you're here.
The escalation came in 1978 when the Rocky Flats Action Group and other peace and environmental organizations forced their local nuclear weapons plant into the national and international spotlight. For a year, they organized in preparation for an April rally and symbolic civil disobedience at the plant. CU students like Ellen Claver joined in.
There had been an earlier demonstration in 77 that I was at that was a much smaller demonstration. And then as things were gearing up for this big 1978 demonstration, I got very active. There were plans for people from other parts of the country, from a group from Hanford, a group from Savannah River, South Carolina. It's not only the crossroads of nuclear power and nuclear weapons production, but it really was a crossroads nationally, too. The weapons that were being produced at Rocky Flats were not only destroying the local environment, but obviously posed a very, very grave threat to the entire planet.
Nuclear war.
Yeah.
Nuclear war.
Yeah.
You're talking about... nuclear war.
And I was quite convinced in those days that nuclear war was pretty imminent.
Another CU student, Kathy Partridge, was working through the Mobilization for Survival to help organize the 1978 demonstration.
There was no reason to dispel that fear. It's interesting now to think, I think a lot of us weren't convinced we had futures. And it was very much a kind of an end game where we were going to fight this because it could very well have been the last thing we did. People kind of didn't believe that anything could be done about it or that there was any good in talking about it or that Rocky Flats was really that bad. It was very much undercover. And the 78 rally, I think, really changed the attention and the focus on the issue.
Dan Ellsberg, the man who blew the whistle on the Vietnam War, planned on joining the April action. After he publicly released the Pentagon Papers in 1971, he survived a trial that could have sent him to prison for over 100 years. Ellsberg reemerged as a voice against the nuclear arms race.
Before I worked on Vietnam, I had worked on nuclear war planning and on command and control of nuclear weapons. Very specifically, a colleague of mine had invented a weapon called the neutron bomb, a guy named Sam Cohen at the Rand Corporation, which I had regarded as the most dangerous object, the most dangerous weapon that could possibly exist because it looked like a little usable tactical nuclear weapon that was more easy to imagine using against troops in combat. The idea of it was that it would kill people, not property. I could see that as the match that would light the thermonuclear war, that would get it would lead to retaliation with bigger weapons, dirty weapons, and start the all-out nuclear war. So I saw it as a very dangerous weapon, and in 1978... it was going to be produced at Rocky Flats Nuclear Weapons Production Facility.
The 1978 demonstrations started on Saturday, April 29th. They called it the Rocky Flats National Action Day. Dan Ellsberg.
It was a blistering hot day, a scorching sun, so much so that I remember I had to go out in the middle before I spoke and buy a Stetson, a cowboy hat, to keep the sun from burning my head. It was a wonderful day for a demonstration. It turned cloudy later.
Over 5,000 people showed up at Rocky Flats that day, creating one of the largest anti-nuclear demonstrations in U.S. history before 1979. The speakers and crowd expressed their opposition to both the local hazard the plant posed to residents of the Denver area and the global threat its plutonium triggers posed to the world. As soon as the main rally ended, Dan Ellsberg encouraged people to join him on the railroad tracks for the first ever civil disobedience at Rocky Flats.
Okay. I was one of the 38 original people who took civil disobedience training before the 78 demonstration. And,
Henry Reynolds.
We're out there on the railroad tracks, and by the time the sun goes down, it starts coming down a drizzling, freezing, cold rain. And we all got wet, and about half of us decided we had to go home. So we went home. In the meantime, somebody else showed up with some plastic, and I came back about 2 o'clock in the morning with warm clothes and found a little tent city being manufactured on the railroad tracks out of plastic. So when we had a meeting, everybody sit on the rails, talk about how many radioactive trains had gone down these very tracks. You know.
But in the morning, there were a sizable number of people left.
Dan Ellsberg.
And I was very impressed at these people. I did have the feeling this was a time to make a stand of great urgency. And as I looked around, and I thought, these are the people to take that stand with.
Ellen Claver.
And I can remember very distinctly in the nonviolence training that went in before the big demonstration in April of 1978, having the discussion of the Monday Morning Breakfast Club, in that we were being told that this was a symbolic action, we would spend the night and then leave, and people were saying, well, why leave if we're going to be in the right place to do something? Why should we leave?
Pam Solo was one of the main organizers of the Saturday demonstration. She thought the protesters should stick to their original plan and leave on Sunday after one night on the tracks.
It was very intense. The day after the demonstration, when the occupation was supposed to end, I went out there, and it was rain and cold, and Dan said to me, we're not leaving, we're going to stay. This is we're going to escalate it right now, and we had quite an intense shouting match at each other. And he said, we're going to demand that Jimmy Carter come here and meet with us. And those of us who had been organizing the long-term campaign just had to make a strategic choice that people were going to do what they were going to do, and that it needed its own independent structure. And that
again, Ellen Claver.
At the time, I felt like, well, a certain amount of impatience with that reaction of feeling like, well, here are people who are more concerned about their word to legal authorities about what we will or won't do than they are concerned about the effect that we can have and the fact that we really are blocking the entrance of the train to this plant. And that fact of blocking that and of stopping the passing of the train and shutting down that aspect of work at this nuclear weapons plant seemed far more important to me.
Kathy Partridge says many people who attended the larger demonstration came to the support of the railroad track occupation, providing food, clothing, and shelters.
But there was a fair amount of people, myself included, that weren't convinced that the civil disobedience was the tactic that I wanted to be involved with. I wasn't opposed to it. But there was also, you know, the civil disobedience tactic is very much about putting your body on the line to speak truth to power. You know, even the name Truth Force was about that. If we, by our example, do this righteous act that and do it over and over with enough people, eventually, you know, power will crumble. The other side of that is that another way of approaching social change is through really mass mobilization or base building or reaching out into the community. The MOB was working with people in Broomfield about the polluted water. So there was a difference of focus, and it's hard for somebody to do both.
The division between those who wanted to do mass community organizing and those behind the civil disobedience led to the formation of the Rocky Flats Truth Force. The dozens of people who were occupying the railroad tracks took their name and inspiration from the nonviolent philosophies and movements of both Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. Dan Ellsberg.
At first, we weren't arrested. They hoped not to arrest us. They didn't want a trial. They didn't want. And in fact, the Rocky Flats was encouraged not to arrest us because of this set of plagues that we got. Strongest snowfall in 100 years in Colorado. It was 36 inches of snow. And they said that was followed by hail. They did expect that to drive us out so they wouldn't have to arrest us. But meanwhile, the view of that the television people were getting back in Denver was very dramatic.
The terrible weather the Truth Force faced during their civil disobedience drew many people to their cause. Rockwell International, who is now running Rocky Flats after Dow Chemical left in 1975, even suggested the protesters could stay as long as they wanted. Rocky Flats officials said the railroad spur the Truth Force was occupying was only rarely used to transport radioactive materials on and off the site.
And then the weather got nice for a few days in there, actually really nice, you know.
Henry Reynolds.
It was cold and raining most of the time, you know. People kept coming out to visit and seeing what was going on and bringing food and bringing clothes and you name it. So it was getting busy and everything else. We released it to the newspapers. We were going to build a nonviolent civil disobedience school right on the railroad tracks and have a library. It was the very next morning we all got arrested.
The Truth Force stayed 6 days before the arrests began. The night before those first arrests, another snowstorm hit the encampment hard, collapsing many of their tents. With heavy snow still in the air that morning, The arresting officers were, in a sense, saving the truth force from the snow, but also acknowledging that Rocky Flats needed the railroad tracks more urgently than originally admitted. The tracks and trains provided the crucial link to the rest of the nuclear weapons complex. Without the trains, Rocky Flats would drown in its own radioactive waste. Over the next few weeks, the truth force would return over and over again to the railroad tracks. They camped out on a nearby plot of private land. Every time a train tried to leave or enter, truth force members would rush to the tracks and sit in the train's way. One night after numerous protesters were hauled off to jail after blocking a train, Nancy Dobb and her daughter Marion saw their friends arrested on the evening news.
So when we couldn't contain ourselves anymore, we went out on the tracks and walked up the tracks in the dark with our flashlights, singing, "We shall overcome and we shall not be moved." And it was a very moving experience for me. It's not the usual thing you imagine for mother-daughter activities, but it meant a lot to be standing side by side with my daughter. You know, it shouldn't just be the young people who are worried about this stuff. It's unfair to give them that burden. So I was glad to be there.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome.
Nancy and Marion Dobbs stopped a train by themselves that night and joined the members of the Truth Force already in jail. For the next 6 months, the Rocky Flats Truth Force held a continuous presence at the nuclear weapons plant. On August 9, 1978, they staged a die-in on the Day of Remembrance of the victims of the Nagasaki bombing. Many people, sprawled out on the pavement in symbolic death, were arrested after blocking for the first time the main roadway entrances into the plant. Noted poet and writer Allen Ginsberg was amongst them.
A couple of very brief poems called Peace Protest. Middle-aged Ginsberg and Ellsberg taken down the road to the gray-haired sheriff's van. But what about Einstein? What about Einstein? Hey, Einstein, come back here. In Golden Courthouse, waiting for the judge, breathing silent, prisoners, witnesses, police, the stenographer yawns into her palms.
Kathy Partridge.
Allen Ginsberg was a big name that got people's attention. Allen certainly participated and early on, in fact, organized poetry readings, which were among the early fundraisers for the Rocky Flats movement.
In November of 1978, the Rocky Flats Truth Force would have its day in court. With hundreds of people already facing charges of trespassing, an agreement was made to hold a special trial with 10 people representing the whole entire group. Ellen Claver, a spokesperson for the Rocky Flats Truth Force, was one of the chosen 10.
We knew from the outset that it was going to be very difficult because we were trying to present a choice of evils defense, saying, well, yes, we did commit these misdemeanors where we were trespassing, we were blocking a railroad, but it was for a greater good.
I felt that each action is important, though, and I felt that our action was particularly important because nothing else seemed to have been working, and this was a chance to really say we mean business. We really want something to be heard about this plant. We want our questions answered, and we would like to have the public more informed. I felt that that was a last resort, and that if they wouldn't listen to me in the hearings, well, they'd listen to me on the railroad tracks.
Nancy Dobb, who with her daughter Marion had stopped a Rocky Flats train.
I believe very much the idea that to see an evil and to not resist it, especially when you've been shown the way how to resist it, is to be an accomplice to it. And I began to feel increasing that I didn't want to be any accomplice to Rocky Flats.
Roy Young was another spokesperson for the Truth Force.
I was on those tracks not to commit trespass, but to attempt to prevent the continuing random murder on the population of metropolitan Denver and upon myself and others of my acquaintance.
Kim Goldberger presided over the Year of Disobedience trial. He heard testimony from the Truth Force members and allowed them to fly in some of the world's experts to testify on the health effects of radiation, especially those caused by plutonium. Goldberger, however, reviewed all the material before deciding whether a jury should hear the testimony. Dr. Carl Morgan was one of the first to testify on behalf of the defendants. Morgan is the father of health physics and established many of the U.S. government's standards on radiation exposure in the 1950s. He told the court that his research over the past 20 years led him to believe radiation was far more dangerous than he ever expected.
That is, there's no dose, no exposure to ionizing radiation so low that the risk is zero. And Dr. Stewart, who's one of the world experts in this field and has examined far more human data than any other person living, will testify later, supporting, I'm sure, this point of view.
This is quite easy to understand if you realize that all radiation has to do is to hit one cell. You aren't ever going to be safe, are you?
Carl Johnson, head of the Jefferson County Health Department where Rocky Flats resides, warned of the dangers plutonium from the plant posed not only to nearby residents, but to the protesters themselves.
Your opinion as to that?
Yes, I felt that to put people in this area known to be contaminated would significantly increase their risk of leukemia, cancer, birth defects, and also the rate of general ill health due to chromosome injury.
At the west gate of Rocky Flats, Evan Frierish, a Truth Force member represented by the 10 defendants, recently reflected on the trial.
And it was just incredible press. I mean, basically, all the issues, you know, really substantive issues, got out to the Denver metro area in the course of about 5 days when the experts were presenting testimony. Then he decided not to let the jury hear it. And then we were convicted. But for us, getting the information out was the most important thing. And the sentence was a year unsupervised probation.
With the disobedience trial of the year over, the Rocky Flats Truth Force took a break as winter set in. But they would be back on the tracks in the spring of 1979, and their next wave of protests could not have been better timed. On March 1st, the Three Mile Island nuclear reactor in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, melted down.
3 Mile Island blew down their lives. Next time it happens, how many will die? Got our eyes on the future, got our feet on the ground. Gonna shut down the nukes, shut them down.
In our next program, we follow the growing protests at Rocky Flats, looking to the 80s, but starting in 1979, when 15,000 people gathered at the plant, while musicians like Bonnie Raitt and Jackson Brown sung their opposition to nuclear power and weapons. The 1980s would see the anti-nuclear movement focused on Rocky Flats reach new heights with the birth of the nuclear freeze movement. They would have to fight against the massive Reagan nuclear weapons buildup, which President Jimmy Carter initiated during his last years in office.
We finally had a Democrat in office who went in saying that he would ban a major weapon system, the B-1 bomber, and then turned around and immediately escalated the nuclear arms race. It was Jimmy Carter who initiated a lot of the new weapon systems, including the ridiculous scheme to move MX missiles around the desert in Nevada. Here we had a Democrat who had mouthed the language of zero nuclear weapons, who was in fact bringing in people into his administration, other Democrats and liberals, who were escalating the Cold War and escalating the arms race.
You've been listening to part one of Return to the Nuclear Crossroads, the history of Rocky Flats protest and activism. This program was produced with the support from the Needmore Fund and KGNU. Many thanks to all the people who provided archival recordings for this program, including David Barsamian, Mickey Houlihan, and Kathy Partridge. If you have a question or a comment about this program, call the KGNU comment line at 303-447-9911. And if you're interested in ordering copies of this program or the rest of this four-part documentary, send your name, address, and telephone number to KGNU at P.O. Box 885, Boulder, Colorado, 80306. Or call us at KGNU and leave a message with the same information for David Wilson at 303-449-4885. For Return to the Nuclear Crossroads and KGNU, I'm David Wilson.
Just give me the restless power of the wind. Give me the comfort and glow of the wood fire. But please take all your atomic poison power away.